We have a moral obligation to those who risk their lives to support us in the field.
He's talking about danger facing Afghans who work for U.S. and NATO troops. It's Tuesday, June 29th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, Aung San Suu Kyi's trial will run longer than scheduled. Another former columnist at a now-defunct Hong Kong newspaper is arrested while trying to leave the city. Coronavirus takes a chunk out of Australia's population. And we explore what the pandemic has done to honeymoon destinations. It is all on today's VOA Asia. As the United States continues to draw down its troops in Afghanistan, the Taliban have intensified battlefield attacks against government forces, capturing more territory. The Taliban advances coupled with the drawdown have left those Afghans who have been working to help U.S. and NATO forces. They fear for the lives of themselves and their families. U.S. President Joe Biden says the situation is being addressed, even as visas that would allow travel for the Afghan workers are delayed. VOA Dari Service reporter Zila Nouri spoke to Ryan Crocker, the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, about the unfolding situation.
Indeed, there is strong bipartisan support for steps to bring our allies to safety, even though the visa processing hasn't been completed. It's the only answer now. Things are moving so quickly. The Taliban is gaining ground. We will have completed our force withdrawal well before September 11 on the current timeline. So we have to move now. It will be difficult. It will be a security and a logistical challenge to get the air support that is necessary to remove, could be as many as 70,000 people. The number of individuals that are eligible, in our view, is 18,000. If one estimates conservatively that each individual would have a spouse and two kids, you're talking over 70,000 right there. So it has got to happen quickly. Steps have to be taken to ensure that the transit of personnel to an airfield is secure. Then, of course, quite a number of aircraft are going to be necessary to do this. So there is no other good solution given the timelines here. That's we have a moral obligation to those who risk their lives to support us in the field. And the only way we can meet it, I think, is through a large-scale evacuation, the people of Afghanistan themselves.
Do you believe Taliban has the ability to topple the Afghan government and regain the control of the country once again, like 90s?
It's very hard to say, but it is extremely worrisome. They certainly have the power to plunge the country into another phase of a civil war, if you will. And we could be seeing violent instability and unrest. We're already seeing it as the Taliban tries to advance into areas they have not previously held. Can that bring the government down? I mean, I have no way of knowing. I have watched with great admiration the courage and tenacity of the Afghan security forces in resisting efforts by the Taliban. It is going to get harder. It is not just our forces that are withdrawing. Our contractors are withdrawing as well. They maintain, for example, the Afghan Air Force's aircraft, fixed wing and helicopter. Well, when those contractors leave, the government of Afghanistan loses the capability to maintain those airframes, which have been essential in the ground forces posture. So part of what you're seeing, I think, it looks like a successful Taliban advance against retreating Afghan troops. It's not exactly that. Without air support, a number of forward positions are going to have to be abandoned. It's a tactical necessity. It doesn't mean that that somehow the Taliban have turned into a the strongest army in the world. It's not that at all. The maintenance of these forward posts was dependent on air support. If the air support goes, these positions are going to have to be abandoned.
So last question, sir. How do you see the role of Pakistan in this situation concerning insecurity concerns in Afghanistan if situation, let's say, get worsened for Afghanistan and Taliban gain more ground? How do you see that Pakistan can play an honest and loyal role as a neighbor of Afghanistan?
Pakistan, of course, has long supported the Taliban. They supported the Taliban back in the 90s in the move to take Kabul, and they have supported them since, after 9/11, giving sanctuary and safe haven to Taliban leaders. The Quetta Shura is now known to everyone. Now the Pakistanis have a problem, and the problem is a return to widespread violence in Afghanistan is going to produce the kinds of refugee flows that we saw the last time around. Pakistan has been greatly affected by Afghan refugee flows, as has Iran. So the Pakistanis have a strong interest in using their influence with the Taliban to ensure that they don't start another massive civil war that produced thousands and thousands of Afghans fleeing into Pakistan's northwest areas. So I would hope very much that the Pakistanis will behave responsibly, will take the necessary steps to ensure that the Taliban do not once more produce a refugee flow that Pakistan simply cannot handle.
Ryan Crocker, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, speaking with VOA Dari Service reporter Zila Nouri. For more information on our top story, head on over to voanews.com or any of our many digital platforms. These are some of the stories you'll find at voanews.com. At least 7 people died, dozens were injured in an explosion Sunday in Bangladesh's capital. At least 7 buildings were damaged because of the force of the explosion. Australia files World Trade Organization complaints against China over wine duties. Indonesia's health minister leads a push for stricter controls as coronavirus cases surge to unprecedented levels. Indonesia recommends Sinovac vaccine for children aged 12 to 17. China to buy pork for state reserves to support prices. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. A junta trial of Myanmar's Aung San Suu Kyi will run longer than scheduled, her lawyer said Monday, with the prosecution still to call nearly 2 dozen witnesses. The coup-ousted leader, who is under house arrest, faces a raft of charges in a trial her legal team had expected would be wrapped up by the end of July. But with 23 witnesses to go, even the close of the prosecution side won't be possible by then, said her lawyer. Suu Kyi was deposed by the military in February, sparking a mass uprising and a brutal crackdown. More than 880 civilians have been killed by the junta's forces, according to a local monitoring group. In Myanmar's second city of Mandalay Friday, security forces fought with insurgents and seized what they call a large cache of weapons. The firefight comes as the country prepares to enter its 5th month of protest following a February 1st coup that saw the elected civilian leadership replaced by a military junta. International Edition host Steve Miller spoke with reporter Cape Diamond in Yangon to get the latest.
Cape, can you kind of break down what the status of fighting between opposition groups is between themselves and the Burmese military? Because the International Crisis Group just released a report saying that it is entirely conceivable that the military junta could unleash its entire military force against civilians.
The Burmese military has been fighting, you know, against the ethnic armed groups, you know, since we have the independence in 1948. But in this time, this is the significant development in the country because like the young people and the students, they want to the take armed control area, and the they got the training, you know, from the organizations. And at the same time, you know, the those activists, you know, the people and the students, they decided to take arm, and they said, oh, you know, they have their own armed force. I mean, it's not an armed force, but a group, like they call it People Defense Force, you know. So those People Defense Force, of course, it is actually under the command of the National Unity Government, which is the, we call it, you know, shadow government. And so, but at the same time, these PDF, they have their own, you know, small groups, you know, in different places. So that's why there was the fighting, you know, shooting with the military in Mandalay. You know, the ethnic area, the fightings are still happening, like Chin State, you know, in Gaya State. So this is a worrying situation for the people as well.
Speaking of worrying situations, as Myanmar enters its fifth month of protests following the coup, how are people looking towards the future?
The youth who are still in the, you know, our area, like Yangon, Mandalay, but they're also doing their, you know, their strategies, you know, going out on the street and protest. But of course, you know, we have the brutal crackdown on the protest, so they could only do the flash mob, you know, protest, you know, to remind the people that we are under the military regime. So speaking to the people, speaking to the youth, so they say that, you know, oh, they won't kneel under the boot of the military, you know. They say, oh, you know, we will never surrender. We will never go down, you know. So we will fight as long as we can, as much as we can. So this is the spirit of this young generation.
International Edition host Steve Miller talking with reporter Kate Diamond in Yangon, Myanmar. Happening now in Asia, Bangladesh has canceled plans to build 10 coal-fired power plants, a government official said Monday, amid rising costs for the fuel and increasing calls from activists to base more of the nation's power on renewable energy. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Local news outlets in Hong Kong say a former columnist at the now-defunct pro-democracy Apple Daily newspaper has been arrested while trying to leave the city. Hong Kong police issued a report saying a 57-year-old man, whose name was not released, had been arrested at the airport Sunday night and charged under the national security law for suspicion of colluding with foreign forces to endanger national security. The police statement did not reveal the man's identity, but news reports identified him as Feng Wai Kong. The Hong Kong Journalists Association condemned the arrest in a statement and warned that if even the pen of a literati cannot be accommodated, Hong Kong will hardly be regarded as an international city. If the reports are accurate, Feng would be the seventh staffer at Apple Daily to be detained in the days before and after the newspaper's shutdown operations. The newspaper's publisher, Next Digital, issued 1 million copies of its final print edition last Thursday, a day after the publisher announced it was closing shop, citing the current circumstances prevailing in Hong Kong. The decision was made nearly a week after more than 500 police officers raided the newspaper's offices and arrested its chief editor, Ryan Law, and four other executives with the newspaper and Next Digital. Authorities then froze $2.3 million of its assets, leaving the company unable to pay its staffers. Apple Daily's closure appears to have had a chilling effect on at least one Hong Kong news outlet, the online-based Stand News, which announced Sunday it was removing older published commentaries and would no longer accept donations from readers. Ronson Chan is a journalist for Stand News.
I think that the situation and the message is clear to from the government that making reports and doing and covering news story will have some criminal result. You may be charged, you may be limited your freedom, whatever. So it's not easy to say that I'm not afraid of the situation.
Although he might be expressing fear, Chan says he and his fellow journalists will continue reporting what is occurring in Hong Kong.
For myself, as I received the instructions that our reports and our attitude towards the news remain unchanged, that we are still doing the report, which means that the incident or the things had happened, we won't dismiss it. We will still report what had happened.
The outlet's publishers said the moves were taken to protect its supporters, writers, and editorial staff. This is VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia, South Korea approves plans to pursue a $2.6 billion artillery interception system similar to Israel's Iron Dome, designed to protect against North Korea's arsenal of long-range guns and rockets. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Thank you for being with us as we continue on VOA Asia. Australia is facing a smaller and older population as a result of coronavirus, according to a landmark government study that is published every 5 years. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The fifth intergenerational report is forecasting slower population growth in Australia due to falling levels of immigration and a sharp decline in the fertility rate. The reports are published every 5 years. They forecast the outlooks for the economy and the budget over the next 4 decades. Modelling has suggested that the economic legacy of the COVID-19 pandemic is going to be felt for many years to come. It's highlighted the ballooning costs of healthcare as the population ages. By 2060, there'll be just 2.7 people of working age for every person aged over 65 in Australia, compared to the current level of 4 people, which puts a greater strain on public finances. The taxes of working age people help to support the essential services for a growing cohort of older Australians. The government has said its challenge was to fund aged care services while maintaining a sustainable tax burden on workers. Australian Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
What this fifth intergenerational report does show is that the Australian economy continues to grow, that we have debt increasing, but it remains sustainable and low by international standards, but that we do have a major challenge ahead of us, namely in the ageing of the population, the longer term impacts of COVID, and the need for Australia to boost productivity.
25 million people live in Australia. The fifth intergenerational report has predicted that number will grow to about 39 million by 2060, which is less than previous estimates. It's the first time that long-term population projections have been revised downwards. It means the Australian economy will be smaller and the community will be older than previously anticipated. Migration has boosted economic growth and can reduce the impact of an ageing population. But Australia closed its international borders in March 2020 to curb the spread of COVID-19, and immigration has all but stopped. Even when travel restrictions are eased, the government says migration levels will take years to recover. Girls born in Australia between 2017 and 2019 can expect to live 85 years, or about 4 years longer than boys. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Making headlines in Asia, Hong Kong police Monday denied permission for a rally on July 1st, the 24th anniversary of the former British colony's handover to Chinese rule, citing coronavirus restrictions, according to the organizers. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Australia battled to contain several COVID-19 clusters around the country Monday in what some experts have described as the nation's most dangerous stage of the pandemic since the earliest days. Sydney in the east, Darwin in the north were locked down Monday. Perth in the west made masks compulsory for 3 days and warned a lockdown could follow after a resident tested positive after visiting Sydney more than a week ago. Brisbane and Canberra have or will soon make wearing masks compulsory. Australia has been relatively successful in containing clusters throughout the pandemic, registering fewer than 31,000 cases since the pandemic began. But the new clusters have highlighted the nation's slow vaccine rollout, with only 5% of the population fully vaccinated. You're listening to VOA Asia. No Paris, Rome, or Latin America. The most popular honeymoon destinations became hard to reach for average American couples during the pandemic. So where do newlyweds go after getting married? Valentina Vasileva has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
Tay and Lisa Britova got married in January 2021 during the second coronavirus surge in the U.S. Instead of a large reception, they only had 10 guests, social distancing in place, and no plans for their honeymoon. They had dreamed of going to Europe or Latin America, but decided to wait because of the pandemic.
It's such a headache right now. Borders open and close again. Tests are needed. The results expire quickly. Well, it's all very complicated. So we decided not to think about the honeymoon for the time being. For now, we hope to have a big reception in October 2022, and then maybe a proper honeymoon in 2023.
In January, Yevgeny and Lena Semenovy celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary. They had planned to celebrate at a Maryland restaurant with family and friends, but large gatherings were prohibited because of the pandemic. So they bought cheap plane tickets and headed to Puerto Rico.
The beaches of Vieques were all ours. Vieques is a small island off Puerto Rico's eastern coast. They were limiting the number of tourists, and the beaches ended up being empty.
Travel agents say many are still willing to travel, but are concerned about the rising costs as restrictions are being lifted and the tourism industry tries to recover profits lost during the pandemic. Agents say many are opting to stay closer to home. Before, popular honeymoon destinations included the Maldives, Europe, and Southeast Asia. Now, many Americans are heading to Mexico, Hawaii, Costa Rica, and other Caribbean destinations. Travel agents add that during the pandemic, traditional honeymoons have turned into the so-called mini-moons, that don't last as long as usual and often involve a short trip to a neighboring state. Bigger trips are being rescheduled for 2022 and 2023. There are so many rescheduled trips that travel agents warn by the end of the pandemic, we could see a honeymoon boom with a shortage of specialized suites, venues, and hotels.
The other thing that's happening is everybody that was booked for 2020 has already rebooked for 21 or 22. That means that there's years of buildup of people who have already arranged a trip and are now pushing it to the next year or the following year.
However, the pandemic brought some good news to the marriage industry. Since reception parties were much smaller, couples spent a lot less on their big day. Travel agents say they're spending those savings on their honeymoons and celebrating in style. For Valentina Vasilieva in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Please stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.